today, gameplay is a catalyst for story sharing. Patrick and I have been working with and on History Pin for coming up to 3 years now. So History Pin is a online digital platform for documenting and sharing photographs and stories to connect communities. And it's been going for about 10 years. We're really into story sharing, and that's kind of mainly what we're going to be talking about today, and how we can evoke stories from people and the value that that creates for people. So Carol was talking earlier about, I guess, the value of kind of reciprocal social interactions in placemaking, and it was just a term that kind of like stuck in my head because that's really what we were interested in as well. So as we get started with this talk, I'm going to get you guys to turn to the person beside you, and they're going to be your new friend for the next few minutes, because everybody loves a bit of like awkward interaction.
There's still big gaps everywhere.
If you're not beside somebody, move beside somebody. It's better if you don't know them. That's ideal. If you do know them, that's okay. But it's only going to take a few minutes, and then you can move back to where you were and forget it ever happened if you want to. Hurry up, man in the blue shirt. So turn to the person next to you, and first of all, I want one of you to start by telling the person beside you like 7 bullet point facts about yourself. Just 7 bullet point facts. And when you're done, just kind of stick your hand up in the air, and then I'll know when everybody's done. Go. Thanks, everyone. That was a long time. Okay, now next, what I want you to do is for the other person to have a go. I was wondering if that's what happened. Okay, let's pretend one of you hasn't gone yet. And let's get the other person, this one's more fun and awkward, let's get the other person to spend 2 minutes telling a story about just a recent kind of experience that they've had. It can be something meaningful, like, you know, a really nice day out or a holiday or a family thing, or it can be just something every day, like making a meal and eating it. But what I want you to do is like tell the story from your perspective. So, you know, like I went to the shop and I saw a beautiful bunch of roses and I thought about a friend and I bought them for her. So very much from the first person. So I'm going to give you 2 minutes to do that, and I'm watching the clock, and once your 2 minutes is up, I'm going to raise my hand, and then I'll ask you to stop. Go.
It's not going to be funny at all. I haven't got any jokes prepared. Probably noticed the difference in how you feel when you receive a set of facts from somebody compared to how you receive a story from somebody. It's a little bit easier to kind of start imagining the place they were in, what they were doing, start feeling a bit of empathy. And I think everybody here probably knows just as well as we do about the value of story sharing and kind of as humans, the way we're built, how we've kind of evolved, it's kind of impossible not to empathize with somebody once you hear their story and really listen to their story. And that's because, as we know, when we tell stories, we start to build up an understanding for each other. And if we do things like, you know, really actively listen, that puts us in a kind of a good position to really see from other people's perspectives and, you know, really get a sense for standing in their shoes. And they're all the ingredients for good empathy building. But what I find fascinating is that empathy isn't just like a feeling, a nice feeling, or like a physiological thing, but it's very much like backed by science, and it's all relating to how our brains work. So when we tell stories, there's a neuroscientist, a neuropsychologist called Yuri Hassan, and he's done tons of work in this area that we tend to follow. And what happens, he says, when we tell stories, is that the listener's brain actually synchronizes with the teller's brain, and it's a thing that's called neural coupling. So when we hear a story, our brain basically fires neurons in the same pattern as the speaker's brain. So when you look at brain studies, the same parts of the brain are actually lighting up. And if you think about the little test that we just did at the start, basically what's happening is
when we exchange facts, there's like two areas of the brain that light up, Broca's area and Wernicke's area. And one of them is all about just taking in the language and processing it. And the other part is just trying to make sense of what those words mean. So like understanding the language. And that's all that's happening. But when we hear a story, those parts are lighting up, plus six other parts of the brain are lighting up, plus several other neural pathways are lighting up. And essentially, it's like I said, it's all the same parts of the brain as the teller. So basically, when we hear the story, we're experiencing something as if we were actually there, as according to our brain and how it's working. That's what kind of the science is saying. And that's kind of what's fascinating about storytelling. And that's why we believe so much in its power to build kind of empathy and connection between people. But anyway, so why am I going on about this? And I think it's like, as we know, as we talked about earlier, a couple of people mentioned the divisions that kind of exist within our communities, our neighborhoods, our societies at the moment. There's age divides, political divides, religious divides. And on top of that, we've got like isolation and loneliness is another thing. So with all these things happening, our kind of social interaction with each other is just reducing and reducing. And this might sound extreme, but when we lack social interaction and when we lack personal relationships, it will basically kill us earlier than if we had it. So in 2015, there was a social researcher called Holt Lundstad, and she basically went with a really open exploratory question that asked what reduces people's chances of dying most. And you know, there's like all those kind of hotspots across the world where people live way longer than everybody else. She basically went and spent a lot of time in those, observing people and communities. And what she found that was even above clean air and exercise, the top indicator of how long we live is social interaction, which is literally when we move through our day, how many people are we talking to and interacting with? So coming back to that kind of like constant reciprocal social interaction and dialogue. So it's like really important. Hold on, I flip my page. Yeah, so this is kind of what we've been, this is why we've been doing what we've been doing for 10 years at History Pin and at Shift, basically working to bring people together through story sharing. Early on, really focusing on the digital platform with History Pin and, you know, documenting photographs and using those photographs as a vehicle for stories. And now more so kind of going back a bit to just face-to-face social interaction as well. I'll talk you through a quick couple of examples of the type of work that we've done that's less on the digital side and going more onto the face-to-face analog side. This is an image of one of over 7,000 events that we were partnering to run in Colombia. So to 2015-2016, as part of their peace referendum, History Pin were asked to work with the National Library of Colombia over there to bridge divides between rural and urban populations ahead of this peace referendum. And to see if story sharing between people could be a way of achieving that. So we were funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and it was a significant project, about 2 years, and we basically worked with existing libraries, 936 libraries, to figure out what this program should look like, made sure everybody's capacity was kind of brought up to the same level, to develop this program, and still kind of, we recall History Pin, we're into photos, and it was still all kind of photo-based, a lot of people bringing together their photos into the same place to share their stories. The peace referendum didn't pass, it was 50.2% to 49.8%, so literally couldn't be more of a division. But we did see some level of impact. Specifically, we measured 12% in social increase in social capital index. So it did show that even though it wasn't quite enough to get the outcome we wanted, it was still an improvement in bringing people closer together and feeling more empathy with each other. This set of photos is relating to a more local project we did. So this was in King's Cross in London. So a big enough area that has changed a lot over time, a lot of gentrification going on, so lots of older and newer communities coming together. This project was a HLF-funded project, which was all about collecting 100 stories from 100 people over the last 100 years in King's Cross to show and kind of represent the diversity that exists there. As a means of kind of creating connection, which is a good brief and a good thing to do, but we wanted to go a little bit further than collecting stories just for the sake of preservation. And we thought, kind of, what's going to happen once we're gone? There's going to be a set of 100 stories, but you know, what's the impact going to be? So we spent a lot of the effort and kind of resources that we had available in that project trying to come up with essentially what we left behind was like a DIY toolkit for local community and cultural organisations in the area to run similar types of projects themselves with their own communities. So instead of us as people who don't even live in King's Cross doing that, it was more about how can we use this money to help community groups just do this for themselves in an like easy way as possible. So at this stage, we were really getting into the idea of just helping communities or using our skills to help communities self-activate instead of us trying to do what people can do better themselves. And then this kind of brings us on to the last example, which is it's called Storybox. This is where we got to the stage where we're saying we can really see the value of story sharing. The evidence is there, and we're demonstrating it in projects like Columbia and King's Cross. How can we keep spreading that kind of ability to self-activate and do it yourself? So we spent a lot of time designing kind of portable toolkits for people to run their own one-off and series of story sharing events. And we partnered with 45 different organisations across the UK and the US as well, a bunch of libraries, museums, community centres, a couple of like residential living facilities, basically where lots of people were, so trying to get into as many community organisations as possible. And that was a project that lasted for 2 years again, where we did see that kind of 70% of community organisers felt like they were bringing together groups who wouldn't normally interact and sharing stories and kind of building empathy as well. So we really started to see the, I guess, impact value of it. We had a pretty rigorous theory of change based on all of the previous evidence that we had gathered, so we were able to start seeing that. So that's just like a really quick example of three types of projects we worked on. I didn't want to go into too much detail, but I think what's more important is one of the main insights that came out of the type of work we were doing. So at this point, we really wanted to step back and say, is the work we're doing any good? Are we actually creating the impact we want? Are we spending the money we're getting funded in the best way? And one of the biggest insights that we got from consulting with lots of our partners and communities was that the kind of programmatic approach wasn't that scalable, even though we were trying to find ways of building things for people to use themselves. At the end of the day, we were still parachuting in, doing some good work, and then like parachuting out. And it was great while everybody was activating and doing it together, but the lasting impact, we questioned it, and we just started to wonder just what if we just really, again, try and take ourselves out of this even more and really understand the needs of the communities we're working with and help them, help everybody to just self-activate for themselves. And that's where we turn to this kind of emerging field of social play. And Patrick is going to talk a little bit more about that.
I am. Hello.
Thank you.
So, how did we arrive at social play? Essentially, nearly all of the community groups that we were working with on programmes like Storybox expressed that really they were looking for methodologies, story sharing methodologies that people could take ownership of themselves and feel like they're part of the production of that activity. Like one of the organisations we were speaking to said that their participants are just sick of being programmed to. So how could we look at alternative methodologies that involve participants, involve communities in the production of those methodologies, and then hopefully enable those people to run those activities for themselves. And so this led us to look for alternative ways to kind of strengthen relationships between groups. without the need for expert facilitation. Because all of us really have the capacity to reach out to people and build relationships with those people. So how could we kind of catalyze that a little bit and try and make it happen in a more kind of natural and meaningful way? And we came across a really fantastic body of research in the field of social play by a guy called Thomas Markussen. And he's a professor in social design and participation. He's from Denmark. And he's really interested in how design can be a kind of political and critical practice. And this is his definition of social play and social games. So he talks about playful games and activities that alter or strengthen relationships and help people to function better together. So all of the work that we've been doing from this point onwards was really kind of guided by Thomas Markussen's work and this idea of strengthening relationships through gameplay and playful activities. So we kind of went back to the research stage a little bit. So for a couple of months we did a kind of extensive literature review, lots of interviews in the field, and we identified kind of four key attributes of gameplay that we think can be really powerful in community engagement settings. There's a historian called Johann Heisinger, and he wrote a fantastic book called Homo Ludens, in which he argues that play is just as important to us as human beings as making and reasoning. It's just as important to our health and the way that we construct our society. And he talks about this quite a special thing. He refers to a play space, so when people are playing, he calls it the magic circle. And it's a really powerful way to think about a kind of a safe space for people to do things that perhaps they wouldn't normally do. So within that play space, you know, we have permission to do those things we wouldn't normally do, like drive a car really fast in a video game, for example. We might inhabit an alternative character when we're role-playing with people. And, you know, we have just that opportunity, really, that permission, which is really important in these kinds of settings that we want to work in, to make sure that everybody's voice is heard. So other things, we know that play, just generally, we've all played games, and we know that when we play with people, that can forge connections with the people that we're playing with. But also, we work together to overcome challenges within games, and that can really challenge our perspectives of a situation, depending on how that game setting is designed. And also through a kind of non-linear storytelling, we can be confronted in a game with narratives that are kind of extraordinary, and they challenge our point of view, and we think that that's really powerful and something we've been experimenting with quite a bit. So I've got a few examples of some really fantastic games, a couple that we've designed and a couple from not only Thomas Markussen but one of our associate designers. So this is a game that was created by Thomas Markussen that I mentioned earlier, and it was made in partnership with the Danish prison system. Prisoners within that system and also social psychologists. And it was part of a 3-year program to build kind of alternative interventions to improve the relationships between long-term male prisoners and their children. And it's essentially, it's a board game, and you might see it's kind of quite a familiar format. It's a reworking of Monopoly. But the aim of the game, rather than earn money, is to build alliances within the prison. So as you kind of move around the board, you start off building alliances with kind of petty criminals, and then as you move around the board, you graduate more towards kind of serious criminals, and then your ultimate aim is to gain alliances with the prison staff. So this is really about what the reality of being in a prison, you know, during a long-term sentence is all about. And so this is a way for young people who are in a vulnerable situation, you know, with a parent in prison, to be able to have discussions about what it's actually like to live in a prison. And, you know, the impact that Thomas Markussen is looking for here is to build, not only strengthen the attachment between a father and their child, but also build resilience for that child outside of the prison. So when people try to make fun of or talk to them about their father in prison, they have ways and means to talk about. It's a great example. It's called Captivate as well, which is an amazing title. This is a game created by one of our associate designers, a woman called Kiara, and she created this in partnership with 100 Japanese schoolgirls. And it's essentially a game about the UN Sustainable Development Goals, but it kind of it enables the players to kind of look at those quite kind of nebulous aims within the goals and think about how they can apply those to their daily life. What are the little things that they can do day to day themselves and with their families to affect change at a global scale? And what's really important within this game is that the start of the game is built with the participants. So the schoolgirls build these families, and the name of the game is the Inukages, and that means that's kind of the family name for each of these groups. And the way they progress through the game is they come across challenges, and then they create advice for each other to overcome those challenges. And really the ultimate aim is to translate that gameplay and the way that people are thinking about these sustainable development goals back into the home and their own context. So the idea is, if you're talking about equality within the game, you can go home and talk to your parents about that same issue because of the learnings within the game. And the next game is one that we created, and this was in partnership with the Museum of London. And it's, you can see everybody there kind of in these strange white lab coats, and that's deliberate. So we used a kind of fantasy role play to enable people to feel safe, first of all, and be able to do quite extraordinary things in the gameplay. So the guy that that set us this brief, a guy called Andrew at the Museum of London, he wanted a couple of games to play with the senior staff at the museum, and he wanted to help them reflect on the relationships they have with each other. And build empathy among those senior staff. And it's basically played in a fictional environment that we set up, so people come into the room. The room is in complete silence, and it's facilitated through a lead player, through a kind of series of cards that they present to the players. And the idea is that a virus has swept the world, and it's harming our ability to feel empathy for other people. And the only way to overcome that virus is to speak our truth. And I won't get into the details of it too much, you can ask about it afterwards. But it enables people to stand up and say very honest things to each other in a really safe and comfortable and also a fun environment. It's really important with all of these games that people are still having fun as well. And this one is our kind of latest project. So this is a live project at the moment. It's called Code Conversations. And we're working with Rushmore Council, which is just outside Farnborough, in a place called Cove in Hampshire. And we're working with a woman from the local council there called Heather. And she's really ambitious and really passionate about the community. It's quite a divided community, and it's quite diverse as well. So there's a kind of a rural, affluent area, but also quite a dense what looks like an urban estate, quite deprived, and her aim is to connect up some of these groups and eventually, hopefully, have that group kind of form their own community-led business. And what we're trying to do is kind of activate that through games and story sharing, and we're going to existing groups, and this was the first one, so this is an over-55s group that meets every Tuesday at 2 o'clock, and they generally come into the room, there's 50 people that go every week, and they tend to sit with the same people each week. So we decided to go in, we mixed it up, and we created a game in partnership with the council. And people were encouraged through the gameplay to share stories about their life, but also start to reflect on their community and what they want to see for the future of Cove. And then the next game after this will be with a group of young people, so something similar but probably using more of a participatory approach, more fun, kind of role play, probably a bit more physical. And then the third game that we're going to be working on is to bring those two groups together and for them to work together through the gameplay to reflect on the relationships they have with each other and hopefully start to forge a group between those older and younger people. And then Heather can go away and hopefully get a bit more funding to carry on that project and attract more people to that group. So that gives you a bit of an overview of where we've gone with play. So that's us really. This is a kind of fledgling social enterprise called Made by Play. I think, we're going to continue to work with communities and workplaces on these types of methodologies, and it's quite experimental at the moment, and we're really open to conversations with people like yourselves. And if you see any opportunities for this type of work in the library system, it would be fantastic to talk about it. That's us.
Thank you.